This morning during the work period, I was usually during the work period, I study. And today I didn't. I was talking with two organizers about organizing. So I came and sat with no, with even less idea than usual. Usual, I come here with a vague idea of something, but today, nothing. Which reflects actually better the reality than my idea that I have some sort of idea. When actually I don't, ever. I think I do sometimes, but I don't. And so when I started to sit, I just allowed things to come up. And what came to me was, well, many things came to me, as with all of us. But something that came up that I thought, that says it, was a koan. In this practice, we use koans, which are little stories. It can be just a phrase. It can be an image. It can be a dialogue. Something that has been throughout the ages used as a tool, a teaching tool, used as a practice method to allow us to cut through our usual ideas and patterns of thought, to experience directly what is, to have a direct experience of that, so close, so intimate that there is no separation. And there are many, 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 many koans, official koans, hundreds. Yet every moment is a koan, and every life is a koan. We can say our true koan is our life. But what came to me was one that is part of a collection from ancient China. It's part of Chinese literature. So in this story, there is a man in a tree, and he is, we don't know how he got there, but he is hanging onto the branch, a branch of the tree, with his mouth. Because he can't reach with his hands or with his legs the tree. And he's hanging there for his life with his teeth on the branch. Someone arrives on the ground. Someone is walking past and says to him, "What is the meaning of Bodhidharma coming to China?" Bodhidharma was an Indian monk, teacher, who came from India to China and brought Buddhism to China. The form of Buddhism that we know now. There were other more primitive versions at the time, but he brought this one. Bodhidharma is also famous for creating the what is called the Shaolin Monastery in China, which also is famous for martial arts. So this phrase, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma coming to China? It means what it says, but it's also used throughout the literature as sort of a catchphrase, which means, actually what the question is asking is, what is the essence of this teaching? What is the meaning of this practice? What is the point of this practice? And whenever it appears in these stories traditionally, that's what that phrase is saying. So this person arrives and says to this guy, who's hanging desperately on the branch by his mouth, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma coming to China? It's an absurd situation, right? If, the story says, if he does not answer the man hanging, he will lose his life. So what does he do? How does he answer this question? And that is what, if we are practicing with this story as a tool, we sit down, we take this story, and we try to somehow resolve it. What do we say? How do we respond to this story? Now, I think this story came to me because I was feeling a bit like that, having spent the break talking, dealing with very concrete issues, important issues, looking at the situation in different ways, and then suddenly hearing it's time to go sit. In a sense, I was like this guy hanging from the tree. I had nothing to hang on to. My mind was full. And there were these people who would be sitting there basically saying to me without saying it, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma coming from China? And I would need to respond. Now, I actually, when I was practicing working with koans, I had finished my koan study and began teaching. But when I was, I actually worked with this koan. And I have since worked with students with this koan. So I'm familiar with it, and it's a koan that's a very alive for me. And it's alive because I never know what will happen. When someone is sitting in front of me in an interview and they're working with this, I have no idea what they will say, where they will go with this, what will come up for them when they are working on this koan, what I will say in response. I have no idea. And this is how we approach a koan. No idea. This is how we approach every moment, in fact. If we come to this koan, the story, and we have an idea about it, that's not it. It's difficult to have an idea about this koan because it makes no sense. It's absurd. You think, this would never happen. There would never be someone hanging from a tree by their mouth and then someone walking along and asking that question. This is absurd. This is stupid. And so our mind can't, immediately we say it's stupid because our mind doesn't understand. It's unfamiliar. It's like the cat, Louisa's cats. They don't understand this room. They don't understand this place where they are. Now they're becoming more comfortable, but they didn't. And every koan is like that. And so exactly how we progress in the work with it, we don't know. Exactly what will come up in our mind with it, we don't know. The teacher doesn't know and the student doesn't know. And even though I have worked on it myself, and in fact I worked on it twice myself because it appears in two of the collections that we study, so I did it twice, and I've worked with many students, I still don't know. I still don't know what will come up. And if I stick with my ideas about what happened for me the first time and the second time, or what happened for individuals, then I won't be open to what happens for the individual in front of me. I will expect that person to behave like the other person. And that's not true. That person will not have the same process as the other person. And therefore, I won't have the same response as I would have with the other person. Every moment is unique. So in a sense, this story is illustrating that. We are basically hanging there with our mouth full, our mind full, hanging desperately to something. I don't know what it is. For each of us, it's something different. I mean, for each of us, it looks like something different, takes a different form. But ultimately, what we're hanging on to is me, this idea of me. At least that's how we have all come to identify what we're clinging to, me. This bag of water, in fact, that is the body, and this what cannot be named that is the mind, or that is everything that is the mind, we put all together and say, that's me. Even though it's changing all the time, and even though we can't really identify it. When we sit and we look at our breath, we count our breath, or we are lost in our thoughts, and we come back. I was saying this with someone yesterday. What do I come back to? I have a very clear sense of coming back. And I say I'm coming back to the present moment, coming back here. We have different ways of formulating that. But what am I really coming back to? That's what I'm clinging to. But what is it? Or I'm clinging to some idea about what I'm coming back to. And I don't want to let go of that. I'm hanging on to that with my mouth desperately because I can't get anything else around it. So someone comes along and asks me, what's the point? What's the essence? What's the meaning? It can also be someone coming along saying, help me. Or someone coming along saying, I need food. It can be anything. It can be someone who needs some help standing up. It can be the phone is ringing and I need to deal with something on the phone. Anything. It so happens in this story, it's illustrated in a particular way. It can be the timekeeper clapping. Something needs your attention. And in order to give that attention, what do you have to do? In this case, it seems quite clear, doesn't it? The story says, if he does not answer, he will lose his life. We have this idea that it's the opposite. If he opens his mouth to answer, he will lose his life. But what does it mean to lose and gain life? What does it mean to answer? All of these fixed ideas we have when we're looking at this story, and they all will come up when we're sitting there with it. We think, okay, let's try to figure this out. What are his options? Maybe if he opened his mouth and started falling, he would be able to grab another branch. Or maybe he can signal to the guy down below that he needs help. Or maybe the guy down below will break his fall when he sees him falling, or we'll try to figure it out. We'll try to make sense of it. And you go to the teacher and you say that, and the teacher will ring the bell. No. And then you'll come back another time and you'll say, well, okay, yeah. I thought about it. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I think that the guy down below shouldn't be asking that question. He really wouldn't be asking that question. He would see and then he would act differently and then everything would be okay. No. Ding, 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 ding. And then there might be something else. If the guy stood down there long enough and waited for a response and saw that there was no response coming, he would climb up the tree and help, or someone else would come along and would see the situation and the other guy didn't see it. No. Ding, 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 ding. All of these attempts to resolve it intellectually fail. Because that's not the point. As I said at the very beginning, the idea, the meaning, the actual profound sense of a koan is to experience it directly. Be that koan. Be it. Make it. You are it. As I've said over and over again, my name, my teacher gave me, is tu es cela, in French. You are that. And that is not fixed. It's not one thing. Or we can say it's always one thing. It's this, it's this, it's this, it's this, it's this, it's this. And there are, as I said, hundreds of these koans, and in the koan study in my tradition, there were 700. So I did this 700 times with these stories, these koans. I wouldn't say that it was always brilliant. I wouldn't say I'm, you know, an extraordinary koan student, but I did it. I did not do it, however. It's not about I. I can never do that. I would not even pass one koan. I would still be hanging there with my mouth on the branch. And I'm not saying this as some sort of example that we all should follow. I'm saying it more in the sense of it's really possible. This is a real living practice. It's not just some story that they tell and that they used in ancient China in the 8th century. It's alive and well today. And I'm sitting here as a witness, as an example of it. So, in this story, what happens then? What do you do? You're hanging from the branch? With your mouth? Your jaw is probably starting to tremble. Can't hang on anymore. Or maybe not. Maybe you have a very strong set of teeth and a strong jaw, and you will hang on forever. And that's how you lose your life. You say, if you don't answer, you lose your life. As the timekeeper says at night, did you say it last night? Yeah. Time swiftly passes by, and opportunity is lost. It's important to recognize that. Well, she says, don't waste your time by day and night. Of course, I can hear the voices speaking from the absolute saying, there is no time. There is nothing wasted. There is nothing to waste. There is no one to waste it. There is no fast or slow. This is to ignore, to be fixed in that point of view, is to ignore the reality of time. It is now 12:20, or it is Monday, April 6th, isn't it? Tomorrow is April 7th. There is someone hanging from the tree, hanging on to something. Now, when we let go of it, that's when we realize that there was nothing to hang on to. But while we're hanging on to it, there is.
can we identify what are we aiming on?
On the one hand, it's not so important to know what it is you're hanging on to. It's more important to recognize the fact that you're hanging on, that you're clinging to. You can feel, it's important to recognize this. You can recognize it by saying, by seeing your judgments come up. You know, like I said, you think, oh, this is stupid, this story. It doesn't make any sense. You're hanging on to something. You're hanging on to an idea of how it should be. I can't do this. This is impossible for me. You're hanging on to this fixed identity you have that I can't do it. It doesn't matter so much what it is. It's more important to see. Usually when we feel a resistance, anxiety, fear, these are all signs of hanging on to something. And sometimes it's useful. Fear is very useful because it protects us from things that might be dangerous. Can we see when we don't need to cling to that fear anymore? What is it that we're afraid of? The guy hanging from the tree is afraid that if he lets go, he will fall. That's one possibility. I'm just putting myself in that situation, thinking, okay, I'm hanging there from the tree. What do I fear? I fear that I will fall and hurt myself. So I have a very clear idea of what I expect to happen. So I'm stuck there. I'm hanging on to that idea of what will happen, and therefore I can't see anything else. So then if I can say, okay, I don't know what will happen. Or maybe I can say, okay, I can't let go of the notion that he will fall, but what happens when he falls? I have a very fixed idea of what happens when he falls. It will be a catastrophe. He will break his neck. Well, maybe I can let go of that fixed idea. Maybe I'm hanging on to this. What will happen? I don't know what will happen. I gave my example of coming here after talking and coming here. Somehow I had this idea of, okay, I won't have anything to say. It won't be good what I have to say, or it won't be clear what I have to say, or it will be, or I won't say anything. I had some sorts of ideas about that. That was the equivalent of me hanging on the tree. I saw I was stuck there, and okay, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what I'll say. I don't know if I will say something, if I won't say something. I don't know. That has happened to me, however. And when it did, the first time it happened to me, I was still teaching with my teacher, and it was my turn to give the talk one day. And I sat down, and I started speaking. I talked maybe 5 minutes. And then there was nothing else to say. There just was nothing else to say. And I stopped. And I was devastated. But there was nothing to say. And I left, and went outside and was crying, and I felt just devastated by this. But it was actually very powerful for everyone. The fact of just being true to what was true in that moment. which is all that this is about, this practice. It's not about saying something or not saying something. Saying something when there's something to say and not saying something when there's not something to say. So maybe in this koan, he's hanging from the tree and the appropriate response is not saying something. Maybe the appropriate response is hanging there. I don't know. And whatever I would tell you as something that happened for me with this koan or that happened for other people, that's not what will happen for you with this koan. It's different for every person. What's not different is the point. The meaning of Bodhidharma coming from China to China is not different, but it looks different all the time. That's the point. I'm suddenly remembering that that text I sent to you was about this. I don't remember what I said, but it was about this. Yeah. So if you're interested in hearing some other thing that I said about it, it's on the blog. And this koan is a very famous koan. This is one of the... It's very popular. It appears in various collections and things. And it's very popular because it's very alive and rich. And most of the koans come from actual situations. If there's a dialogue between two people, that actually happened. And someone heard about it and thought it was a good story to use as a teaching example. You know, I could make up, I do make up koans sometimes. I could say, you know, I could make up a koan, Louise's Cats, as a teaching example. They come from actual life, and then they're recorded and they are used. And they are used in a way that each person who uses them makes them their own. Makes it their own. They become it. That's the only way to do it. There's no other way to work with the koan. You can try to figure it out with your head, but the bell will just keep ringing. No. So anything come up for anyone with this?
Okay, question. A response to a koan. I was thinking, yesterday you talked about taking a situation and responding on the way that the situation is according to the situation and not bringing fear or anger or anxiety or yesterday I was thinking about a practical situation in daily life. A response to a koan should come from the same place?
It can only come from there, yeah.
Although it's different because the koan, it's not a like you said, it's not a, something to work. It's not a practical thing. It's not a, it's more, I don't know if I can say a more absolute thing. Well,
if we, as long as the koan remains something outside, something, just a story that we're using as a tool or something, we will not resolve it. The response will not appear. which is the same for any, for a very concrete daily life situation too. Of course we will come up with some response, but it won't be the response that is really true for that situation because we're separate from it. And the same with the koan. So we will come up with replies, that's what I'm saying. You know, you will try these things that come from your head, which come from a place of separation. But that's not it. The only way to resolve it is to become it, to not be separate from it. So, in this koan, you become the guy hanging from the tree. Or you become the guy asking the question, whatever. That's the only way. There's no other way to resolve this story. Because there is no other way to resolve the koan of every moment except to be it. You have to be there. You have to be it. You have to be fully in the moment in order to be fully responsive and fully engaged in the situation. We go through, this is why we say we lose our life. We go through life partially. We think we're really there, but, you know, we're holding back. We have only one foot in the water, say. We're hanging on. It's like we're talking with the branch in our mouth. We're not really saying what's true for us. We want to be nice, or we want to avoid conflict, or we're afraid of being too strong, or we're afraid of being too weak, or all of these different things. And so it's like we have this branch in our mouth all the time, and we're talking like half, we're not really saying the real thing. And therefore no one really understands what we're saying, and we say, think it's their fault. They don't understand me. But I'm talking like this, so they can't really understand me. And they're talking the same way. So it's like this conversation going on with two people with branches in their mouth. What? That's right. That's right. So that's how we say we lose our life. And at the last moment, when there is that last breath that we will take, it's not coming with us, any of it. Right? The branch is gone. We lose it whether we let go of the branch whether we want to or not. At some point, that's it. So do we want to wait until that final moment? Or do we want to do it before? And therefore gain our life. Live it fully. Not partially. Not walking around with a branch in our mouth. Now this is the aspect of for ourself. In the koan, someone else is asking for something. Can I let go of the branch not only for myself to gain my life, but in order to speak more clearly and help that person? Instead of talking with a stick in my mouth, maybe it would be more helpful to not, to let go of the stick. And really the whole point of the practice is to be, like I said the other day, fully engaged in the world with compassion. meaning I'm fully engaged with the others as well. If we really let go of the stick in our mouth, we then realize that it's not, because the stick in my mouth is my attachment to myself, right? When I really let go of it, then I see that it's not only about me, because I am not limited. I am not this tiny little closed-in being. But it's for all of us. And I'm acting, I'm letting go of the stick for the others, not only for me. Of course, we have to start with ourselves. That's where it starts. We use the image of saying, you can't free anyone else from prison if you're still in prison, right? So you have to get out first, and then you can show the others, help the others, show them the way. And it's even more subtle than that. It's that by freeing the others, you free yourself. This is what we call the bodhisattva way. The bodhisattva in this branch of Buddhism, which is called Mahayana Buddhism, the realizing one's self, realizing the way, as we say, is not just for oneself. It is for all beings. That's what the Buddha's initial teaching was. He realized, suddenly when he looked up in the sky and saw the star for the first time, that he and all beings had the same nature. They were one, as we say, and they were all at the same moment awakened simultaneously. Because he's not separate. So the bodhisattva, we say, is one who takes the vow to allow everyone else to pass before him. And that is his freedom. He's free of his attachment to himself. He's allowing everyone else to go before him. And if that means someone needs to, he needs to hold their hand across the street, okay. If that means he or she needs to give someone food, okay. If he or she has to come to Portugal for a week, okay. If she does it in France for a week, okay. If we need to talk before the talk, okay. And then if I need to talk, I talk. If I don't need to talk, I don't talk. Whatever is called for. So you can see in this story there are many different aspects. It's not just one. Of course, there's the initial point between quotes. But it's very rich. So that was in response to your question. Did that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah. And in a sense, when we come to a retreat like this, we are manifesting this koan, We are all coming here, choosing to step out of our usual way of functioning. We don't know what will happen. We come together, we sit down alone, but all together. We all participate. Everyone does their jobs in order to help the others, to support the group, but also to support their own practice. We each have our individual practices, and they each look different. But we're all doing it together, and we're all on the same path, if you will. And everyone contributes to making the place where we can pursue that together. So we're very much doing exactly what the Bodhisattva does, that we are doing our practice, but for the others as well. And we're not doing it so that, you know, Tiago and Yvonne and Thomas are not cooking so that we will all say how wonderful they are, and they're brilliant people, and we love them more than everyone else. That's not why they're cooking. They're cooking because we have to eat, and someone has to do it. And I think somewhere they enjoy having that opportunity. Maybe not always. Sometimes it's a big job and it's a responsibility, and they wish they could sit here. But I think somewhere they have this appreciation for what they're doing, for helping others. And the same with the timekeeper, and the same with the person who cleans the zendo, and the same with the person who serves, and the same with the person who washes the dishes, and the same with the people who organize. Everyone does it not for themselves only. They wouldn't do it otherwise. If they were just doing it for themselves, they wouldn't do it. It doesn't make sense, right? And the only way to measure the success and failure of it is to do it. And there is no success or failure if you just do it. There's no... How would you measure success and failure when you have no other motive than to do it? Of course they would like us to enjoy their food, to appreciate it, of course. And we do. But that's not why they're doing it. And of course, Luisa, she wants us to appreciate the fact that she's keeping track of the time for us, and we don't have to think about it. And that she's doing it well, and she's ringing the bell when she's supposed to, and doing everything. Of course, she wants us to appreciate that. But that's not why she's doing it. And the same for the organizers. They're organizing it, but not because they want us to think that they're so efficient and so capable and tireless and devoted. That's not why they're doing it. They're doing it so that we all have a place to practice, and we can all come together and do it, so that they too can come and practice. So in a way, we are all, this whole week, responding perfectly to this koan. In a very direct way. Boom. Clear, direct, no mind, no thinking, no hesitation, a direct response to this koan. Of course, no one knows that. You don't realize that you're responding to it. And there's a difference. With every single koan, in fact, I could say the same thing. The first koan that we start with, that we give people, is the koan mu. And people struggle with this and fight with it and they go crazy with it, and then they say, I'm not going to do it anymore, and then they get bored with it, and then they don't think of it for months, and then they come back to it, and all sorts of epic battles in the literature. There's a guy who stayed with it for 20 years. In some traditions, it's the only koan. In the Korean Zen practice, it's the only koan. You stay with it forever and ever. But what is the truth of it is that everyone is always giving the response at every moment, but they don't know it. And I am always telling the response, but nobody hears it. Very funny story. One of my brothers, Dharma brothers in the Sangha, in fact, two brothers who I practice with, one of whom is also a teacher now, their mother once came to a retreat because she was so curious to know what her sons were doing. And before that, she had read... first she came to the retreat and she heard all of it. She stayed for 2 weeks. It was quite amazing. It was a month-long retreat. She stayed for 2 weeks. She sat in a chair and she sat through the whole time, did everything. And at the end of the retreat, she went home and she read a book that was written by the teacher of my teacher. The book is called The Eye Never Sleeps. And in the book, he talks about mu. The teacher talks about mu. And so she read this book because she had heard about it. And then one of her sons came and he was struggling with mu and had told her about it or something. And she said, well, you know, why? You're wasting your time. You just read this book. He tells the answer right in the book. I know the answer to mu. But of course, if you don't know it, you don't know it. You don't see it. And there's a difference between reading the answer and experiencing it, the direct experience of being it. So the point is not to read books and find out the answers, because those aren't the answers. The point is to be it, to experience it directly. So I say, you know, we are all now here manifesting the response to this koan. Well, yes, we're manifesting the response to every koan, but we don't know that. And there's a difference, and that's the important difference. Anything? Anyone have a response? I don't often talk about koans, and a traditional way of teaching Zen is to take a koan, read it, and then do an official commentary on it. That's what a lot of teachers do, and then those become books. And then there are books that have commentaries on the commentaries of the koans. And then there are books with commentaries on the commentaries of the commentaries on the koans. And poems about the koans and commentaries on the poems about the koans and on and on and on. I don't really do that in a formal way. But maybe I will sometime. I don't know. So this was not an official commentary on a koan. Okay. And when you come to this koan in your studies, if you ever do it, you will probably remember this, but it won't help. But it might. That's not the point. The point is to open a possibility for you to realize yourself, and providing some answer that someone else gave is not that. Okay.
One o'clock and six.
Okay. So maybe we can take a brief break and then come back and sit just 15 minutes.